You're listening to the River East Church Podcast, a Jesus community for the world.
Several of these books change or redefine the field of Old Testament study. His work on the Psalms is one of those areas. I use his books and articles every time I talk the Psalms course over the 30-some years. He revolutionized my understanding of the Lament Psalms, and he allowed me to find a place in my own spirituality for the experience of the hiddenness and the silence of God. He has a tiny little booklet called The Spirituality of the Psalms. I should get it, put it in the life. His book, The Prophetic Imagination, first published in 1978, went on to sell a million copies. It was a watershed publication, a small book that offered a new understanding of what the prophets were all about and a new vocabulary to describe them. I also signed this book as a textbook every time I taught the prophets. So now I'm going to offer you a slightly adapted talk he gave at the Sojourners Magazine Summit for Change in 2018. That's 40 years after the publication of The Prophetic Imagination and in the middle of Donald Trump's first presidency. If you've been following analysis of what's going on in the United States in the past 6 months, you will be able to read between the lines here very clearly. And if you're like me, you will find enough here to make you uncomfortable. And of course, there's always the retort, yes, but. You're welcome to say that, but listen. I chose this talk in part because prophetic ministry is one of our core values at River East Church. You can find it on the website. We believe that Christ has called us to do justice, listening and acting for the least, the lost, and the left out, things Christians have traditionally called prophecy. I think this talk will help us understand and fill out what that might mean. So now I am going to be Walter Rubin. And if it ever comes to me that I have something to add, I will do this. Then come back. That's what I call an aside. I may or I may not. When I did this on Thursday night at Jubilee Church, I had about 3 or 4 asides that are not in the script. But if it doesn't come to me, I won't do them. So I have concluded that the prophets can only be understood if you understand that their context is an ideological totalist that intends to contain all thinkable, imaginable, doable social possibilities. That totalism always wants to monopolize imagination, and it wants to monopolize technology so that there are no serious alternatives that seem on offer. By totalism, you know, think of what's going on right now in all the ways in the United States. In the ancient world of the Bible, that totalism is
represented and embodied by the monarchy of Solomon in the Jerusalem temple. The king was surrounded by priests in the temple and by scribes who did the fine print so as to legitimate everything. And that totalism was completely intolerant of any alternative thinking. We can identify many of the features of Solomon's totalism. First, it was an economy of extraction that regularly transferred wealth from subsistent farmers to the elite in Jerusalem, who lived off the surplus. The device and the strategy for that extraction was an exploitative tax system. That great big bill, which transferred wealth to the corporations and to the billionaires. At the death of King Solomon under his son Rehoboam, there was a tax revolt, and they killed the tax officer who had regressive tax policies. That totalism also represented a strong military. Solomon, as you heard, was an arms dealer. Partly Solomon's military was for show, and partly it was for intimidation. The totalism also had to exercise enormous economic opulence to impress people with wealth, so that Solomon's temple is essentially an exhibit of Solomon's very much gold, which you can read about in 1 Kings 4. The temple and the priests who operated the temple fashioned a series of purity laws to determine who the pure people were, to determine who had access and who was excluded from the goodies. And this whole enterprise of extraction and exhibition and grandiose commoditization was blessed by a very anemic God, whose only function was to bless the regime. So that under Solomon, you get a chosen king, a chosen city, and a chosen land, to the exclusion of all who were not chosen. And this totalism was completely impatient and intolerant, impatient with and intolerant of any alternative thinking. It was prepared to crush such thinking, which was represented by the prophets. What you get is the expulsion of the prophets, the killing of the prophets, because they challenged the totalism that was legitimated by this anemic God. So for 400 years, you get a recital of kings of the family of Solomon, and these are the point persons for the extraction system. But when you read along in 1 and 2 Kings, you also see the prophets show up to unsettle the kings. First of all, they don't have any credentials that legitimate what they want to say. Remember, Amos said, "I'm just a farmer from nowhere." Second, they come from nowhere. They are people who do not accept the truth of the totalism, and the way that they articulate their coming from elsewhere is that they say, "Thus says the Lord." The Lord is a euphemism for Yahweh. But of course, the Lord is also imperial language. And it becomes a kind of a signal that this is a word that will not fit or accommodate the totalism. It's an alternative empire that the Lord represents. The prophets, moreover, were deeply grounded in the old covenantal and wisdom traditions. They knew that there were structures and limits that were inherent to the way of creation. They have a vigorous notion of the governance of God, but along with that sense of tradition, they have an acute sense of social reality. They know that if you follow the money, what you see is that the extraction system produces many grievances and cries of oppression and exploitation. So when you add all that up, no credentials, coming from elsewhere, knowing the tradition, doing social analysis, it's not surprising that the characteristic idiom of the prophets is that they speak in poetry. Language that on the one hand is porous and elusive and slippery, and on the other hand, that can be dangerous and offensive and scandalous to people who live inside the regime. So, what you have when you read the royal history is the managers of extraction who tend to operate with unambiguous executive orders. And disrupting that are these poetic voices that are dangerous and subversive because they are voices that come from outside the totalism and that refuse to accept the totalism as normative. Now, if you take the phrase prophetic imagination, the imagination part of that is that the prophets can imagine the world other than the way that it is in front of them. And the prophets, and what the prophets believe is deeply, they believe deeply that God is a lively character and a real agent who acts in the world, who causes endings and new beginnings. If you consider most conservative evangelicals, they do not believe that God is a lively character and a real agent, because they've got God all packaged up into sustained, systematic, and ideological explanations. And if you consider most theological progressives, they don't believe that God is a real character and a lively agent either, because they really believe that God has no hands but ours. So, prophetic imagination is grounded in the conviction that God is doing something lively in the world. It may be slow, but it is very sure. A new world is coming into being that will discredit and dismiss the old totalism. Now, that dismissal comes via three prophetic tasks. The first prophetic task is to be clear on the force and illegitimacy of the totalism. And what we have to recognize is that almost all of us, conservatives and progressives, are to some extent habituated into the totalism. We take it as normative. And to take that as normative is a great narcotic that makes us passive and apathetic. Becoming clear and unambiguous about the force of the totalism is a teaching point that we really have to work at. The second task of prophetic imagination is that we have to pronounce the truth about the force of the totalism that contradicts the purpose of God. That's what's called prophetic judgment. And my sense is that in the institutional church, we are very quiet about prophetic judgment because we are too deeply committed to totalism. Think of the Jeremiah passage we heard a moment ago. But if we understand the totalism honestly and clearly, then we have to talk about that contradiction. And we are able to say that a predatory system of economic extraction contradicts the purposes of God. And that the extraction system in which we live lives by cheap labor. And as we know, the history of cheap labor is grounded in the institution of slavery. So many of our economic arrangements are simply trade-offs to continue the practices of slavery. And particularly, if you think about the things that go around cheap labor and slavery, what you come up with is that this system is committed to the deregulation of banks and all sorts of deregulation that lets creation be exploited. It's happening already now. Deregulation really means the unleashing of predatory forces against the vulnerable. The totalism in which we live is also a system of incredible militarization, including the militarization of the police. And the totalism is committed to consumerism. It believes that the more stuff we somehow make will somehow make us safe and will somehow make us happy. So this combination of acquisitiveness, militarization, and consumerism adds up to a doctrine of exceptionalism, which gets translated into make America first, make America great again. And it is all blessed by an anemic God who has no function except to bless white nationalism. So, this is clearly addressed to a United States context, right? So, you all can say, that's not me, that's not us. Okay, that's fine. We can talk about that later. So, what prophetic judgment amounts to is making the case that acquisitiveness leads to violence, that militarization leads to bankruptcy, that consumerism leads to the evaporation of citizenship, that ecological exploitation leads to chaotic weather, that silencing leads to brutality, and that exceptionalism leads to white tribalism. It's a package that needs to be exposed at the teaching level of the religious community. As Brueggemann, right? Not me. So the first task is to identify the totalism. The second task is to identify the contradictions that put us on the route to death, because one can see that we now live in a society that is engaged in self-destruction. The third task of prophetic imagination is to articulate the alternative world that God has promised and that God is birthing before our very eyes, if we have eyes to see it. It's not often noticed that for all the harsh judgment of Amos and Isaiah and Jeremiah, there runs through their rhetoric extraordinary promises about beating swords into plowshares and not learning war anymore. All of which, I think, have come to fruition in Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream. It is a dream that imagines a world that is completely alternative to the one in which we now live. So I thought I would take a stab at identifying with you four dimensions of that future, the prophetic imagination that we ought to be imagining. These are probably obvious to you, but there is some merit in lining them out. The first of these is a new ecological perspective in which the earth and all the creatures of the earth are treated like covenant partners who are entitled to dignity and viability. Every acre, squirrel, radish, whale, cornstalk is entitled to viability and respect. Wendell Berry suggests two ethical reference points for this perspective: restraint and frugality. I'm going to just jot those two words down: restraint and frugality, because he's not going to develop those ideas. But what environmentalism, this new environmentalism, is an alternative to the kind of world of plastic accumulation that is killing our oceans and our ocean creatures, just to pick one example. The second facet of prophetic promise is a new ecumenism. Listen to this carefully. A new ecumenism that makes room for other chosen peoples other than white Western Christians. Now, that does not mean that we have to give up our claims about Jesus. After all, we are in the process of rediscovering Jesus. But it means to recognize that our claims about Jesus are not universal statements. They are confessional statements about how we intend to live our lives. And that means that we have to make room for other religious traditions and find allies where we can be about the main prophetic tasks of justice and holiness. The third facet of prophetic imagination is a new economy that is organized around love of neighbor and that is committed to the viability of the marginalized. In the ancient world, widows, orphans, and immigrants were excluded by the totalism of a patriarchal and royal society. So this became a test case for the economy. The prophets advocated for the vulnerable persons and for policies of redistribution. And obviously, the 1% or the 3% or whatever's at the top intends to keep extracting from the vulnerable until we have only the 1% and a big collection of subsistence peasants who have no economic viability. So what we have to do in the church is to educate ourselves that we are not really in the charity business. We are in the justice business. And fourth, the prophetic imagination means a new multiculturalism that opposes white nationalism and all that's now making white America great again. The Bible, because of its permeation with chosenness, lends itself too easily for that reading of tribal chosenness. But there are all kinds of hints in the Bible to the contrary, that chosenness has to remain open, that God is in the business of choosing many other peoples. The best text I know in the Old Testament is this anticipatory text. At the end of Isaiah 19, the prophet says, "On that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. The Assyrians will come to Egypt, and the Egyptians to Assyria, and the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. On that day, Israel will be the third, along with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing at the center of the world. The Lord will pronounce this blessing. Bless Egypt, my people, and Assyria, my handiwork, and Israel, my inheritance." Not a text we read or hear very often. This is nothing other than a recognition that there are many blessed, chosen peoples. And in the New Testament, surely the lead text is Peter's incredible vision in Acts 10, where God tells him to eat impure food to violate the old purity codes of Leviticus. And out of that comes this incredible dawning on all of the apostles that the good news of God's transformative love in the world is not a monopoly of any race or tribe or nation or tongue. So the practice of prophetic imagination requires energy, courage, and freedom, and the sense of being otherwise. And I have no doubt that we are now arriving at a moment when there is no more middle ground. We either sign on uncritically to the totalism, or we take on this task of dangerous oddness that exposes the contradictions and performs the alternative. Finally, I want to make a comment and then I'll be finished. To make a comment about the institutional church. The institutional church is a very weak instrument for the prophetic imagination. But it is the best instrument we've got, because when people come to church, they expect us to talk funny. They expect us to talk about God. And I believe we are now at a point when the church has got to recover its nerve and its energy and its courage and its freedom. To be about our proper business, the church cannot engage in prophetic imagination as long as it lives in the cocoon of the totalism. And that, of course, is where many want the church to stay. Because you get rewards for that, and you get a kind of security. But our mandate and our vocation is otherwise. I think the church now must be more vigorously engaged in scripture after having been lazy for a very long time. And the church must do a better job of social analysis than we have done. The good news is that the Spirit is moving among us. It is the Spirit of Jesus. And Jesus is that great voice of otherwise, who saw the contradictions of the gospel to the Roman Empire and who acted out an alternative. Good Friday was the last desperate reach of the totalism of the Roman Empire. They did their best, and I've come to think that we shouldn't use the word crucifixion. We should use the word execution. Jesus was executed as an enemy of the totalism. And Easter is that strange, wondrous gift of newness that rushes beyond the totalism. It is no wonder that Mark ends his gospel by saying that they were afraid. It is very fearful to discover that the totalism is not normal, but it is the truth of the matter. Amen.
Thanks for listening to the River East Church podcast, the Jesus Community for the World. We are an Anabaptist church pursuing wisdom, prophecy, and compassion here in Winnipeg, Manitoba. If you'd like to learn more about us, you can find us online at rivereastchurch.ca. We hope you join us for next time, and until then, may grace and peace be with you.